Funding Drive donors. Thank you so much.
Tanya Dahaskigo, then on Zewatahun Sadaje, Ungahuwa and Hadiwanodas, in the Aboriginal Voices, Oscar Dewanyawa Oscar, Ne Jota FM, CFRC.
Hello and welcome to this new episode of Viewpoints. Hope you're all enjoying the season. On this week's show, in Montreal, Quebec, an exhibition called To All the Unnamed Women shines light on Black women of Montreal's past.
The two groups, the Colored Women's Club and the Porters, actually were the ones who created what we know now as being the Union United Church. And it's through the church that I was able to find multiple archives on the Colored Women's Club. I feel like in multiple cases, women are always in the second place in history.
Peter Burroughs, a poet laureate, Ziza von Bieberstein, performs her poem February at the Peterborough City Council.
I think what poetry can do is remind us of what's at the foundation of all of this. Why do we care? Why are we connected in community? Why are we trying to make decisions together? And what is our bigger vision for our community?
And the screening room will host Kingston's inaugural Home Movie Day, exploring the theme of transience. Homemade movies hit the big screen.
This is the inaugural edition in Kingston. Home movies are typically linked with nostalgia, so it seemed fitting to go with the theme of transience, but we wanted to keep it as open-ended as possible to let the folks who might have some home movies up in their attic or whatever that they want to dig out, you know, some creativity when they're thinking of submitting to us.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Welcome, happy to have you with us. I'm Boris Chassaigne. Our show this week will be all about the arts, cinema, visual arts, and poetry, and this will be your point of entry. In collaboration with the Electric City Culture Council, Peterborough's second poet laureate, Ziza von Bieberstein, launched Poets of Nogijwinang, a catalog of spoken word artists in the community. The project, which was launched on September 3rd, was initially created in April of 2024. 30 local spoken word artists were commissioned to share a writing prompt on social media. These poets and their writing prompts are now all collected in a single webpage. Von Bieberstein hopes this directory will make it easier for people to find professional poets for work. Poets of Nogijwinang is Von Bieberstein's legacy project, a piece of work that is expected of each Peterborough Poet Laureate, in addition to three performances at municipal events or city council meetings. Here is Edward Sweeney in Peterborough, Ontario, in conversation with Ziza von Bieberstein.
In 2021, the City of Peterborough and the Electric City Culture Council, or EC3, first appointed a Peterborough Poet Laureate, choosing Sarah Lewis, a spoken word artist from Curve Lake First Nation. Then, in April of 2023, Ziza von Bieberstein was chosen as Peterborough Nogijwinang's second Poet Laureate, and their term is ending this September. So this month, we will see their final performance at City Council, and they have launched Poets of Nogijwinang, their legacy project, which is one of the responsibilities of the Poet Laureate. So to talk about this project as well as their experience in this role, Trent Radio invited von Bieberstein into the studio.
So it's something that I've wanted for many years, probably since we started the Peterborough Poetry Slam, I think 20 years ago. And spoken word artists were being invited to events and things, as I've wanted there to be a way that spoken word artists could be profiled online and that people could find them directly, because it sort of was like an underground movement, and if you weren't part of it, you didn't really know how to reach people. So that's something that had been on my mind for years. And then as Poet Laureate, every Poet Laureate does a legacy project, and so I thought that would be a wonderful project to be able to connect not just spoken word artists, but all poets in the community to the community. And in April, it was National Poetry Month, and EC3 invited me to curate something for Poetry Month. In the last several years, they've done that, and they've usually curated about three poets to create a video for one of their poems or a series of poems, and they share that So I thought, is there a way we could stretch this to include, you know, as many poets as possible? At the same time, Peterborough Poetry Slam usually hosts a National Poetry Month challenge in April where they post a writing prompt every day. And so I checked in with them and they said, we can't figure out how to do it this year because we're just like at really low capacity. So it just, all those things came together to create this project where we were able to commission just a writing prompt from 30 mm-hmm. different poets in the community and post one each day on Instagram. And so each day, anyone who followed on Instagram, each day they would be introduced to a new poet in Ngojuanong. They'd see their picture, they'd be connected to any work that they had, any website they wanted to connect them to, and they'd be given a writing prompt challenge for that day. And then I thought, can we connect this to my other goal and catalog it so that it's not just something people looked at in April, but it actually, we have all the information we need now to post this directory.
So the initial project was happening in April earlier this year, but the website cataloging Poets of Ngojuanong was officially launched this September.
Yeah, so between collecting all the consents and information for everyone and working with the web designer and then working with the organization and everyone's summer vacations and mm-hmm. illnesses, it was launched last week.
Yeah.
And it's great. It was great. I was interviewed on Ontario Morning on CBC. So, yeah, people really like the. I didn't even know that the press release went out, and I was getting contacted about it mm-hmm. by poets in the community who were like, how can I get added to the directory? So, yeah, it seems like people are intrigued and excited mm-hmm. about it, which is great.
People may have heard the term poet laureate before. It has been around for centuries. There is a Canadian Parliamentary Poet Laureate, as well as some at the municipal level across the country, like that of Peterborough. But for those that aren't sure what it means, von Bieberstein talks about defining that role.
A poet laureate, and I also kind of don't like defining it because I've noticed this wonderful surprise I had becoming poet laureate is seeing how people respond to it. And I know we're on the radio, people can't see my face, but you can probably see this, like, I'm looking up because people would come up to me on the street and be like, say, you know, oh, I heard you're the new poet laureate, or are you the poet laureate? And their faces would just, like, light up with this type of delight. That was very surprising to me. And it wasn't about me. It was about this concept of poet laureate. And it's like this whimsical idea that people are just delighted by. Like, they're picturing someone, you know, riding through town, like, handing out poetry or something. I'm not sure. So I would ask people, like, what are you excited about? Mm-hmm. And they would say, I don't know. Like, they don't know what it is. They don't want anything in particular. They just love the idea that we have a poet laureate. And so I like kind of celebrating that whimsy and celebrating the fact that we're creating what a poet laureate is. But officially, I would say that a poet laureate champions poetry and the literary arts and promotes it and celebrates it within the community, and then also represents Peterborough, Ngojuanong outside of the community in literary and poetic spaces. And so, yeah, to answer the question of what a poet laureate does more technically in terms of the contract mm-hmm. Between me and the City of Peterborough and EC3 is four original works presented at official city events and one legacy project.
Poets of Ngojuanong is von Bieberstein's chosen legacy project that will outlive their term as Peterborough's second poet laureate. So I asked them why this is the way they want to be remembered.
I had a lot of ideas. I always have more ideas and like desires to do things than there's capacity for. But I definitely wanted my project to be something that broadens the field, allows more people to be involved in poetry, more people to access poetry. And actually in the like pre-interview for CBC, they asked me about this and like, why would you want to focus on more people and not on your own work or something? Mm-hmm. And I was saying that, you know, I really I sometimes do this organically and sometimes it's something I have to practice and train myself, but I'm really like against a scarcity viewpoint and approach. And I think that we're really like fed that through capitalism to think that like the way to make our lives better and grow our happiness is to like amass as much stuff as we can for ourselves. And it can be translated even into things like, oh, you have an opportunity, you have a platform, you know, use that to promote yourself. And I think that the more it's counterintuitive to that approach or belief, but actually the more poets that are working as poets, the more attention a wide variety of poets get in our community, the more space is created for poetry.
During their term, von Bieberstein has performed twice at City Council and will perform for the third and final time at the upcoming meeting on September 23rd. As their role as Peterborough's Poet Laureate comes to an end this month, I asked them why they feel poetry and this position is an important thing to have in this community.
Poetry offers possibility. It broadens the field of what is possible. And so to say exactly what it would do would be sort of counter to what it does, which is to, yeah, open that field of possibility. And I think that, you know, the poem I read in February, which was called February, I received so much feedback about, and people felt, I didn't realize how many people watched the streaming of City Council meetings, but people who are connected to the politics, what's going on in the city, seeing people struggling with housing, people in tents who are being harassed, how much addiction is impacting people. Like being able to afford food, and then the development projects that are happening and how they're impacting people. Those are just local issues, and there's all the global issues. And people are connecting with City Council over some of these issues. And then to hear, I think when they heard me speaking to my own depression and struggle with these things, it was really, I think, humanizing and like affirming for people to know that, to hear some of their experiences or their friends' experiences reflected and in the context of a meeting. It's I think we get our scope and our view can get very narrow. I know it is for me when I'm in a position like a city councilor is, if I'm at a table making decisions or in a board meeting and you have an agenda and you have a limited amount of time and you have specific things that have to get done and you have people that are angry at you for your views. And you tend to have this very narrow scope of what you're trying to do. And I think what poetry can do is remind us of what's at the foundation of all of this. Why do we care? Why are we connected in community? Why are we trying to make decisions together? And what is our bigger vision for our community?
The Peterborough Poet Laureate Legacy Project, Poets of Ngozi-Wanong, can now be accessed online at EC3's website. And you can watch von Bieberstein's final spoken word performance in front of City Council on September 23rd. This has been Eddie Sweeney, reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative here in Peterborough, Ngozi-Wanong.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
Okay, Bennett Gore. Okay.
The McCord Stewart Museum has put together a new exhibit that pays tribute to black women in Montreal between 1870 and 1910, to all the unnamed women. An exhibition by artist-in-residence Michael Sergile shines a light on the Colored Women's Club of Montreal, the first organization in Quebec to be created by black women, as well as black women from the museum's photographic archives. The work is part of an ongoing art archival project for Sergile. She and collaborator Nancy Olivier McKenzie will launch their website, Black Samaritan, a Black Montreal archive, at the museum on November 8th. Here's Jules Bugiel in Montreal, Quebec.
Last Friday marked the opening of To All the Unnamed Women at Montreal's McCord Stewart Museum. The exhibition by artist-in-residence Michael Sergile is a tribute to the lives and contributions of black women in Montreal between 1870 and 1910. In particular, it shines a light on the Montreal Colored Women's Club, the first organization in Quebec to be created by black women.
It's a group that was founded in 1902, and the idea was to mostly give access to new immigrant families to financial support, finding houses, but also schools for their kids. And the idea was really literally just to have some support from a community.
The exhibition tells that history and that of some of the women who came before it through different media. But the room is centered around seven weavings that reproduce archival portraits. Sir Gilles says working in textiles was a natural fit given the subject matter.
It's a medium that has been categorized as feminine, as craft, as not necessarily something that we would see in contemporary art, even though it's changing lately. But it was a medium that for me made a lot of sense with the subjects that I choose to work with, since I'm working with untold stories or stories that are often in the margins, communities that are often in the margins, and also communities that lives into different intersections. I thought that there was something very beautiful in working with a medium that itself is in the margin, but also a medium that in French it's maybe more clear, but it has a lot of a connection with the lexicon that we use when we talk about weaving and cultural identity. For example, we do say tissu social, social fabric, but in French, to say that someone is mixed, for example, we can say métissage. We use also the word tissage, which means weaving. So there was connections that I thought was already there between weaving and the subjects that were interesting for me.
Sir Gilles has spent the last year as a museum's artist in residence, giving her access to the McCord Stewart archives. She says that what she found and didn't find shaped the form the exhibition ultimately took.
The archives that I found were mostly photos from the Notman's collection, which is William Notman was a really well-known photographer in Montreal, and he photographed a lot of people in Montreal. But the little amount of archives of photos that I found were mostly women unnamed. So I was really interested in, at first, give a social context to the Colored Women's Club, but then I was facing the fact that maybe I needed to give also a social context to these archives. So the first part of the show, when we come in, it's three weavings, actually, of three photos from the collections. And I specifically chose these three because I wanted to have different contexts for each one. One which is a nursemaid on her own, one in the middle part, which is a couple that came on their own, not with another family, just on their own, having their photos taken. And another one, which is a nursemaid and a baby.
But the recreations aren't wholly faithful. Sir Gilles uses a technique of black silhouette.
We can see on the weavings that I didn't put the face of the subjects. And it was not in the idea of erasing them at all, but mostly because for me, just like archives, there's always a surprise in the end. There's always more to learn. And I felt like they were more like something very deep that needs to be excavated, almost like a hole. I've been working with that technique for my own family portraits, but then I realized that for this exhibition, it would make actually a lot of sense to work with these silhouettes as well.
It also mirrors what's lost in these women's stories, saved in the archive only in relation to their white employer.
The photos were identified with the family who came in for the photographs. So we would have, for example, for the woman holding a baby, it would be baby Packard and nursemaid. So we have the last name of the baby because it's the family who hired that woman to be there with the baby and to be the nursemaid of the family. But then we don't have anything about her.
Sir Gilles says that if black subjects were seen as less than, black women experienced this twofold.
In the notes, it's only written Mr. Evans and Lady. So even they came on their own, and it's not in a subaltern position or a position of them being employed by a family. It's still in the same situation where the woman is not named.
She situates these unnamed women as predecessors to weavings of members of the Colored Women's Club, whose faces are shown in full. That's because these archives come from a little Burgundy institution, a church where these women, along with Montreal's black railway porters, were founding members.
The two groups, the Colored Women's Club and the Porters, actually were the ones who created what we know now as being the Union United Church. This church is still very much active, and it's through the church that I was able to find multiple archives on the Colored Women's Club. A lot of people kept things maybe not in the best conditions because they don't have necessarily the access that an institution like a museum has, but we still have information, and we have people who knew them and people who were part of one's family and then this other person's family. So we do have a little bit more of history, and I wanted to show them. So one, we can see them. And second, we would be in a position where people might recognize them.
Sergil says that even with these women already known to their community, it's still important to make sure their stories are being told.
I think in general, when people do know about their church, they tend to know about the Porters more than the women who also contributed to that story. So that's why for me, it was important to hold into that story and to make sure that I can give as much as I can to these women, because I feel like even though I think we should talk a bit more about different communities in general in Montreal, I feel like in multiple cases, women are always in the second place in history.
With the launch of the exhibition, she hopes that these women will stay in the minds of those who visit and spark questions about an undertold part of Montreal's history.
I just want them to recognize these women. I want them to know their story, or to at least try to understand their stories. And if they do have more information, to contribute to it. It's a lot of things that I didn't learn at school at all. And it's things that I had to dig and research and read to have the information that I have now. So I just want to make sure, knowing specifically that I'm in a space where it's an institution that is also an institution of knowledge, in a sense, I wanted to make sure that people would have access to that information, knowing that I didn't.
On November 8th, Sergil is launching the website Black Samaritan, an archive of Black Montreal, including the Union United Church, with collaborator Nancy Oliver McKenzie. The event, which includes a guided tour and community dinner, is free by registration. To All the Unnamed Women runs at the McCord Stewart Museum until January 12th. I'm Jules Bijal, reporting with the Local Journalism Initiative. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
Back to Ontario now. Transience, the temporary nature of things, and the passage of time is the theme of Kingston's first Home Movie Day, an event presented by the Kingston Film Heritage Project and the Vulnerable Media Lab. Home Movie Day has been celebrated at venues worldwide since 2003, bringing communities together to watch their own home movies and amateur films on the big screen. And Saturday, October 19, will be the inaugural event for Kingston. Adam Cook, one of the organizers of the event, says home movies are typically linked with nostalgia, so it seemed fitting to go with the theme of transience. Here he is speaking with journalist Christina Laurie in Kingston, Ontario.
Yeah, Home Movie Day started over 20 years ago. Basically, a group of film archivists were concerned about what was going to happen to all the home movies shot on film specifically during the 20th century. A kind of concern that we share at the Vulnerable Media Lab, which is housed in the Film and Media Department at Queen's. And it's an annual event held around the world with different participating cities where local home movies are exhibited for a public audience. This is the inaugural edition in Kingston. And we're really excited to be the ones hosting the first ever Home Movie Day in Kingston.
Yeah, awesome. What was sort of the inspiration to bring it to Kingston, and how are you and your team feeling about spearheading this inaugural year?
It comes naturally to us working in the Vulnerable Media Lab, which is a state-of-the-art historic media transfer remediation and restoration research lab. Basically, we scan, digitize, and restore various media, including celluloid film, but not limited to it, mini DV tapes, VHS, et cetera, et cetera. So we're always looking to embark on new projects internally at the lab, but also curatorially. We like to engage with the public, engage with Kingston, and specifically with the Kingston Film Heritage Project, which we've been running for some months now, we're looking to engage with the city's history, archival materials of the city, and now in the case of Home Movie Day, material produced by locals or people living here. It's okay if they're just passing through, too. Our theme for the first edition is transience.
Yeah, for sure. And could you get into that theme a little bit, transience? What was the choice there, and what does that mean exactly?
Well, what it means is something that we're happy to leave to the interpretation of those curious about submitting. Transience, of course, could really be used to describe home movies and vulnerable media in general, of course, the temporary nature of things, of material, but also the passage of time. Home movies are typically linked with nostalgia, so it seemed fitting to go with the theme of transience, but we wanted to keep it as open-ended as possible to let the folks who might have some home movies up in their attic or whatever that they want to dig out, some creativity when they're thinking of submitting to us.
And yeah, are you hoping that this event will continue to be an annual thing in the future, or are you guys just kind of rolling with it this year?
Well, ideally, yeah. I think it would be wonderful if this could be an annual event in Kingston and ongoing as part of the Kingston Film Heritage Project. What it actually turns out to be is really in the hands of the people listening to this right now. Submissions are open now, and we are open to anything.
Sure, so they have a great start to the season.
If people want information
their
about how to submit their home movies, potentially have them digitized for their own posterity and then potentially projected on the big screen, they can do so now. If they go to the Screening Room website, because that's where we will be hosting the screening, you'll find information there. So it's up to the people who submit their home movies what kind of content we'll get and how much, what the volume of submissions will be. Hopefully it's popular. It's important to us to keep the barriers to a minimum for this event. So it is pay what you can, with proceeds going to a charity, all our relations land trust. And we'll be accepting submissions for the rest of the month and then hosting the screening October 19th at 1 p.m. at the Screening Room.
You can visit screeningroomkingston.com for more details. This has been Christina Laurie on Kingston's very first Home Movie Day.
Film submissions are accepted until the end of September. More information is available at screeningroomkingston.com. That's it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists, Christina Laurie, Edward Sweeney, and Jules Rigel. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative. My name is Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer. Thanks for being with us this week, and until the next, ciao.
Radio@frequencynews.ca. Thank you. Hello and welcome to another episode of Plug to My Ears. This is Adam here with Sam and Kyle, and we've got a really good episode today. We're going to take a look at the Ottawa Senators preseason lineup as they play the Leafs tonight. There's also a few familiar faces for me in that Leafs lineup. I know we're going to be looking at some ex-Habs, but we're also going to take a look at some PWHL new names. And Kyle found a pretty funny Easter egg in the Ottawa Senators lineup when he was scouring the web today. So, Kyle, what's this abnormality that you found in the lineup? I feel like there's someone that shouldn't belong there.
Well, you know, a couple guys I don't think I recognize, so we got a couple newbies. I'm not sure how good they are, but yeah, a couple AHL guys we had to call up. I also noticed we have David Perron, who the Senators did trade for early in the season, which I do remember, but I just, you know, it didn't come to my mind until now that him specifically is an interesting trade, because David Perron actually had a little bit of bad blood with the Senators last season, right? So he got a 6-game suspension against Artem Zub after Larkin was knocked out kind of randomly on the ice. So yeah, just interesting that he got traded to Ottawa, given that I'm not sure that was his favorite team last season.
You know what the crazy thing is Perron actually signed with them. That's crazy. He wanted to go to Ottawa. He wanted to see Zub.
Money talks.
Even worse than that, like, Ottawa's loyalty, you know, to some degree should be to Zub, but that means they also sought after him.
Yeah.
That's a big statement. I don't wonder what that means for a locker room that already doesn't have great chemistry.
You know what? I think it is. I understand it's a piece they need. They kind of want a bit more veteran presence, to say, and he's kind of got that, I'm not going to say stability, because clearly he's not that level-headed based on a 6-game suspension against the Sens, but,
yeah,
you know, no. It doesn't take much to increase the kind of experience and level-headedness on the Ottawa Senators, which have definitely struggled with that in the past.
At the same time, though, like, he was sticking up for his teammate, right? You know, obviously it was a little unnecessary, the cross-check, but, I mean, the Ottawa needs guys like that. They need the veteran leadership. Sam, when you were playing hockey, did you ever, like, you know how, like, teams change from years to year sometimes? Did you ever have someone that was, like, on a team that you hated, and then all of a sudden he was on your team, and you had to, like, try to be like teammates and friends with this guy?
Yeah, and actually that guy ended up becoming one of my really good friends. In Ottawa, if you're from center Ottawa, so I guess the central downtown area, you play for a team called the Ottawa Sting. Mm-hmm. Ottawa doesn't have AAA until you turn, I think it's 14 or 13. I think it's 13, because that's what they changed the names, but yeah, I'm pretty confident it's 13. And when they do that, the 12 AA teams turn into 5. And so you become a team with your rivals. And there was one guy I always competed with because he was the only guy to also hit puberty at age 10. And he's in the NHL now, Roman Schmidt. He plays for Tampa Bay. He was really, really good, but we always had huge, huge, huge confrontations on the ice. I guess that's probably the best way to put our entanglements, as has been famously said by other celebrities. But when we ended up being on the same team, we ended up being D partners. And at first, I will concede, tensions were a little bit high, but after we ran each other a few times at practice, we realized that it's actually a lot of fun to beat the crap out of your teammate to make each other better. And it ended up working out for the best. So maybe David Perron and Artemi Zub will be good friends. But it is, you do run a risk, because simultaneously there's another guy on our team who also didn't like Roman Schmidt. And that friendship didn't really ever come to fruition. It really just stayed as a vindictive relationship pretty much for the 3 years before they both got drafted to the same OHL team, and then Roman went to the U.S. to go play in the USNDTP, so that wasn't a problem. But nonetheless, it can be a good thing. Like, it worked in my benefit. I mean, I think that season I had the most points ever because I was playing with him. Okay, and we just fed each other the whole time from the point, all day, every day.
Nice.
So, yeah, there's some merit to it. I think that was a good thing to bring up.
And you know, you guys back then, you were kids then, too. And if you guys were able to get over it, I'm sure the Senators will be able to get over it with this David Perron guy. So.
Yeah, I just, you know, David Perron's issue is just that Ottawa, it has a really bad culture. I don't even know if the guys on the team get along with each other. And I shouldn't be making these impositions without any actual knowledge. I'm just saying, Ottawa doesn't really have a winning structure, and that might hinder some of its success, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, we've really ripped on the Senators the last few episodes. Yeah. You know, I think it's enough. Let's talk about a different Ottawa team, the Ottawa Charge. Sam.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting name. I mean, I guess everyone who has electric cars will like that, but because they'll be charging them getting to that rink. But the Boston Fleet's an interesting name. Minnesota Frost, that's not bad. Montreal Victoire, Montreal Victoire, I guess is the way we should say it. That's, that's a lot to live up to. They got to win quite a few games. New York Sirens, Toronto Scepters. They're not bad names. I've just don't know if they're great names. What do you guys think?
I think a lot of people online were super upset with it just because most of those feel like just zero effort. Like, there was not too much thought behind a single one of those names. Like, they're kind of just like filler names. And I made a joke saying they're AI a while ago, but they're almost too generic to be AI. Like, it's like, yeah, if you used an AI software, I think it might actually be better than what was spit out here. So, I mean, yeah, it's almost like you used one of those old, like, your random name generators, like one of those super old softwares, yeah, and just had like six of those get spat out of it or something. I don't know.
I'm gonna go on ChatGPT right now and see if we can get some better names.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you guys seen the logos yet? Like Ottawa's logo, the Ottawa Charge logo?
Yeah. And that's
it looks like a company ad.
Yeah. No, the logo's not too good. The only Montreal's logo I kind of liked.
Yeah. Victoire's not bad.
But the rest of them, yeah, again, it just seems like, I don't even know, like, this is almost just randomly produced, so, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny that, you know, it's funny that we have a team called the Toronto Scepters, like, I wouldn't have expected a religious connotation in a PWHL name either.
No, I don't know.
That really matters, but that's an interesting decision, but also Ottawa's logo just looks like that of Calgary.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are making jokes that Ottawa's logo looks really similar to the Calgary Flames, like weirdly so, actually. So
yeah, these guys need a Ford Mustang to be their mascot. I think that's the way forward, being called the Ottawa Charge. But anyways, Adam, did you come up with some good names with ChatGPT here?
ChatGPT came up with a few good names. The Montreal Majestics, which reflects the prestige and history of Montreal in the hockey world. I think they got it better with Victoire.
Yeah.
That's better. The Ottawa Guardians.
Actually, that would have been a good name.
Emphasizes strength and the protective role, nodding to the capital city's political importance.
I like that. That's a good name.
That's not a bad one. The Toronto Titans.
That's an issue. That's already a team in Toronto.
Yeah, it is.
Oh. Under like minor hockey, Toronto Titans, you play that from U7 all the way to U20.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Because there's another one that they came up with down here that is like the New York Liberty. That's a WNBA team. Yeah. But ChatGPT also came up with that. The Boston Rain, which highlights the city's legacy and ambition to remain a dominant force.
Well, that makes more sense than Fleet. Boston Fleet's a bit of an interesting name. Was that supposed to be the Fleet of the Bluecoats heading over to England to go conquer the homeland?
And then the Minnesota Freeze. That's an interesting one, too. Gold Winters, you know, Minnesota hockey culture. I think these kind of... Minnesota Frost is not too different from Minnesota Freeze.
No.
Yeah.
Actually, their logo's fine, too. Like, the stylized F is not terrible.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah, our point is, we just did that in 3 seconds. So, But that's about as much effort as what went into these ones.
I'm excited for the season, though. It was really entertaining last year, actually, to watch the PWHL. So hopefully.
It'll be interesting, too, with the adjustment of salaries, because it's the PWHL directly that pays the players, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And so they allocate the money to whichever team's winning. So I think this is the first year where that allocation is legitimate, mm-hmm, right? Like, if a team's bad this year, I think they just don't get a good salary.
Yeah, it's pretty... So the PWHL works... we explained this last year, but it's kind of confusing. So, like, you can have, like, really large discrepancies the way that the PWHL is, like, based. Like, you could have a player on one team that's getting, like, 10 times the salary as someone else on another team, which is like just a completely different structuring almost than NHL, and there's baseline pay rates and a bunch of different structuring on that. So
my point more so with that though is, like, say Toronto, I forget their name again, the Scepters, become the dominant team, every single good player is going to want to go exclusively to Toronto, which is just going to make it be that if you go play for Toronto, you make a lot of money. Basically, this is going to become the English Premier League, in my view. Yeah. Even though it's a completely different structure, it will become the English Premier League, where there are two, three, four good teams, and then some okay teams, and then some teams that, frankly, would be relegated if they could be relegated. But they can't, because this isn't a relegation league. But anyways, let's move on to a more interesting conversation. Right now, Toronto Maple Leafs, in a very unorthodox way, are playing their starting lineup against Ottawa.
Yeah, I know. I cringed when I looked at the lineup, seeing Max Pacioretty on a Toronto Maple Leafs roster. Ah,
that must have hurt, pal.
He's still kicking.
But I mean, obviously, Montreal Canadiens captain, one of the better players, and when I was growing up watching Montreal, so that's interesting to see. But yeah, it is very rare for teams to go with their full starting lineup in a preseason game.
I think it's just that usually, from my understanding, it's kind of like a message sort of sending thing. I mean, they're just trying to... I think it's actually more the coaching sending a message to the players that just because you're this, you know, top star, you're still going to have to put in the work. Like, you're still showing up early, and you're still training like everyone else that's on the bottom line. Mm. It's like, I honestly wish Ottawa was doing the same thing.
Oh, yeah, it would make sense.
Does it surprise me they're not? Not really, but yeah.
But well, do you guys think more generally that this is reflecting a changing in the mentality of the coaching staff in Toronto?
Partially. I mean, I'm going to say that the believe it when I see it is a pretty accurate description of that.
But... Well, apparently they don't play music at practice anymore, which I wouldn't have even liked anyways if I were to be on the team. But
distracting, yeah.
I don't know. I think this could blow up in their face. You know, injuries happen in the preseason, and I mean, it's still a physical game, and also they're playing Ottawa.
Like, and there's guys on that roster who are trying to prove a point.
Exactly. It's going to be people playing hard. It's not going to be I think it's going to be a rough tilt, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But we'll be interested to keep an eye on that game, see how that goes.
Yeah, and can we also talk about Sidney Crosby re-signing with the Pittsburgh Penguins for $8.7 million?
Yeah, we talked about his contract for a while. You know what? I mean, no one's surprised, like really surprised that he re-signed. It did go on for quite a while, though. That was definitely interesting that it was just seemed to be dragging on for so long.
Yeah.
We all knew that he would sign the superstitious contract with 8.7, or some people predicted 10.87, but he took the lower paying deal.
Yeah.
Hey, good for him.
It's a 2-year deal, right? So, yeah. I mean, yeah. If he feels he wants to go somewhere else, try to win a cup at the end of his career.
You know, I think the icing on top of the cake would be him going to Montreal and bringing the Stanley Cup back to where it belongs.
That'd be cool. You know, he's gearing up for it. He's like, okay, give Montreal 2 years to get into Stanley Cup contention.
He's waiting until they're looking nice.
Yeah.
But, I saw something interesting about people debating, like, you know, what could have Crosby realistically have just asked for a contract? And most people's answer was just a blank check. Like, he literally is most of the profit for Pittsburgh. If he leaves, like, attendance would just plummet.
It's true. Yeah. What else is? I mean, Carlson's great, but Sidney Crosby is the identity of the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Yeah, I mean, the best analysis I heard of it was that when you're watching a Penguins game, there's only a couple things you're looking for. You're watching Sidney Crosby, and you're like kind of living off the nostalgia of the big three from before.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, once that's kind of gone, they've got to restart a completely new legacy, right? So it's kind of nearing the end of an era, to say.
Oh yeah. Big time, big time. Just because it's in the news, and you know more about this than either of us do, and probably more than these reporters do, Montreal has a bit of a competition going on for the last few spots on defense.
Yeah.
Before the show, I had a few questions, and then you gave me an answer I wasn't expecting, but who do you think is going to break the roster for those last few spots as defensemen?
I think that some of it is wishful thinking, that I just want to see certain guys succeed more than others. Not that I don't want to see all the Montreal Canadiens succeed, but I do want to see way that I see the defense turning out is Matheson and Gouley on the first line, which a lot of people expect. Mm-hmm. Hudson and Savard, that's kind of expected. But then the last line is where things get interesting. So I think Arvid Jacki has a spot in there. And then the last spot, I want to go to David Reinbacher, who Montreal selected with their fifth overall pick 2 years ago. Now, the competition is between him, Justin Barron, and Logan Mailloux. So it's going to be interesting to see who gets into that last spot. But Montreal's also thinking about, there's been rumors about another trade before the season even starts to try to move another defenseman. So,
well, I can tell you one guy's not going to get traded from that list of three.
Mailloux or?
I just don't think.
I think it's going to be Barron.
I just don't think Logan Mailloux is going to, like, no team's going to take him from Montreal.
I think the point is that Montreal might move David Savard.
Okay.
So then they can move one of them up and then only have one of them start the season in the AHL, or one of them starts a healthy scratch and just rotates out. I know Montreal did that with Jaden Struble for a little bit, and that's another defenseman that's there, is Jaden Struble.
Yeah,
like they are log jammed at defense with prospects. Like,
yeah, they have too many.
Yeah, and
that's a good problem.
Yeah, at least they got rid of Jordan Harris. I mean not got rid of, but they traded Jordan Harris to Columbus, and like that was a great trade return wise just because they really had no need for Harris because they have so much young talent on defense. So I think it'll be, I think I really want to see Reinbacher make the team just because a lot of people were hating on him when he got drafted. They're like, oh,
saying it was a bad pick. Or,
yeah. They just want, everyone wanted Montreal to take Matvei Michkov. And looking back, it looks like that might be pretty good. He looks like he's doing pretty well in Philly's training camp. So I don't know. We'll see. Not a huge Justin Barron fan. I definitely would say I prefer the other guys.
Barron, is that based off style of play? Or?
Barron's just more of a liability on defense. I think he does bring more of an offensive prowess to the game. He's got a good shot on him, and he's a good moving defenseman. But I think he's honestly getting close to reaching a ceiling. I don't know if he would even be a top four defenseman in his career. I think he's
Well, I mean, the thing is, he trains with McKinnon and Crosby in the summer, and they both described him as the best, the person with the best vision they've played with. So clearly there is, he might be, it's true that he might be at a ceiling, but clearly there is something to work with. Although you're right, it may not be this year. And you're right, he may never be more than a top four defenseman. But I think he does have NHL merit. But I agree, I don't think his spot's necessarily in Montreal. I did think it was for a second, but your argument was rather convincing.
Yeah, no, he's a good defenseman, and I think that he probably will stay in the system. Like I said, I think they'll move David Savard. I think that's who they're going to trade, just because he's older and getting near the end of his contract, and he brings playoff experience. He won Stanley Cups with Tampa Bay, so he's been around the block. He knows what he's doing, and I think he would he'd be a good addition for a team trying to push for the playoffs.
Very well said.
Another team that is pushing for the playoffs but currently has a big hole is the Boston Bruins, with Jeremy Swayman. They have not been able to re-sign him, and he says he's not showing up to the team until he gets a contract signed. So very interesting, because you know they traded Allmark to Ottawa, who, and everyone was like, oh, okay, they're convinced Swayman's the guy. And now they're struggling to sign him.
So what happened is a lot of people are predicting that he's asking for like huge amounts. Like he wants 10 mil.
He might. I mean, I don't know if he's worthy of 10 mil. I'd say, well, okay, look, here's what the thing is. Boston doesn't really have that much to bargain with. They don't have a goalie.
Okay, the other thing is, the thing is they want to sign him long term. So if he won't take anything less than 10 mil a year, and he wants they need a long term deal, they're going to have to sign this guy for like 80 million, maybe more.
You think 8 years, 10 mil, or 10 years, eight mil?
8 years, 10 mil.
Well, the thing is, look, if he's asking for 10 mil, that's a little bit overambitious in my estimation. If he asked for 8 mil, I think Boston would oblige, though.
But the thing
even
is,
nine, maybe.
The thing is, he's got all the cards in his hand.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. What's Boston going
to
do?
They've put themselves in a bad spot here, because there's other teams that are willing to sell the farm for Swayman.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Bruins are in a tough spot here where they're going to either have to basically sideline some people and, you know, sell their farm for him when they thought they had him kind of locked up. But doesn't seem like that was the case. And they traded Allmark, so now they really have no options, right? So they've put themselves in a bit of a pickle, to say.
Adam, what do you think about it?
Yeah, I think it's an unfortunate situation for Boston. Obviously, I don't really like Boston, so I mean, I like to see him squirm a little bit, but I mean, so Swayman's a good goaltender, and he deserves to get paid. I think he's a Vezina caliber guy.
So you think he deserves 10 mil?
I would pay him 10 mil if I was Boston. I think that there's very,
regardless of circumstance.
Not regardless. If there was a viable backup, I would not be giving Jeremy Swayman 10 million.
Okay.
I think I would be giving him around 8.
Yeah, but I think it's fair.
Like Boston has, like Kyle said, put themselves in a pretty bad situation where they have no control over these negotiations. Like I think they're going to have to give in. And I've seen the general manager, I think it's Don Sweeney is their general manager, or let me look that up real quick. But
can't remember.
Anyways, he's like talked all about how he's like frustrated. That is Don Sweeney. Frustrated about how the Swayman hasn't reported to training camp, but I'm like, it's your job to sign him. So like, the only person you should be blaming is yourself.
And in fairness, he's not getting paid. Why would he go?
Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah. So I'm saying the 10 million figure kind of as a guess here, but he could be asking for anywhere between 10 and 12 million. I'm not joking. So he's asking for a huge amount of money.
Well, are there any insider scoop information that's been released about what's going on with their talks? Or
I
guess there's been no reports. It's just suspicions and hunches.
Like he's looking for like a Carey Price deal or something. Like he's looking for huge money.
Well, I mean, I don't blame him. I just like to say, as we speak, the Sens and the Maple Leafs are playing in this preseason game, and Ottawa's winning 1-0 with a bunch of no-name practice players. Yeah, so
starting off strong.
That's interesting. But hey, it could be a fluke goal. Who knows?
Yeah. Who scored it?
Well, apparently I no longer have Sportsnet Plus, so I don't know yet, but I will find out. Oh, Shane Pinto. No, not Shane Pinto.
The gambler.
Jenick.
Jan Jenick.
Jenick. Nice. Sorry, not nice. Jenick. Jenick. Yeah.
No, I think you're right. Jan Jenick. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, that's good. That's good. I hope Ottawa does well, you know?
They might. They could. But I don't know if you guys have been paying much attention, but the NFL football, I believe there's a pretty significant game tonight. No, isn't Dallas playing against?
Dallas is playing right now.
Against who?
Baltimore, and it's 28-18 with a couple minutes to go. But I think Baltimore's got that one wrapped up. They should be able to hold the 10.
Wasn't that supposed to go in Dallas's favor, though, or no?
I wouldn't say so. I think Baltimore was 0-2 to start the season, but they...
I thought that's why people thought Dallas was going to win.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just not a big Dallas fan. I am surprised to see San Francisco and the Rams are tied right now at 24.
But who did you think would have came out on top, San Francisco or?
Well, the 49ers were up 24-7, so it's been quite the comeback by the Rams. So
a big time.
Both all close games. And then tonight, Kansas City plays the Falcons, and my Buffalo Bills play Monday night against the Jacksonville Jaguars.
So. Who's the QB on Buffalo again?
Josh Allen.
Yeah, that guy's not bad.
Oh, he's better than not bad. He's fantastic.
Yeah, we don't really talk about football that much on this show, but maybe we should take the time to do it now. Autumn, like, what are your thoughts on the Bills and their likelihood to get back to the conference finals and then maybe win it and go to the Super Bowl this time around?
Well, if you were to ask me 2 weeks ago, I would say, you know what, this team's going to struggle to make the playoffs because they lose Stephon Diggs in the offseason. They downgrade on defense. They don't bring back Jordan Poyer, Micah Hyde. They don't bring back any of their really solid veteran defenders. But then they come back and they win the first two games, and the offense looks fantastic. They beat Arizona against Kyler Murray, which is never easy. The short little scrambler he is.
Yeah.
And then they dismantled the Miami Dolphins last week. So, I mean, I think they look good now. I mean, the Dolphins are a divisional team that I thought they were going to have a lot of issues with, but the Bills look good. They're 2-0, off to a hot start. I wouldn't be surprised if I think that they've got what it takes now because the way I watched their offense, I was like, this is majestic offense.
Majestic.
So they have essentially three or four wide receivers that are not stars, but they're all consistent and they're not divas. They don't complain. If they don't get targets, they don't get targets, but there's always an option open. It's like it's depth. That's what they have now. They have depth instead of one star player that's going to whine and complain when he doesn't get the ball.
Mm.
So Josh Allen no longer has to force it to him. So now they've got Dalton Kincaid, tight end. They got Keon Coleman, Curtis Samuel, Mac Hollins, Marquez Valdez-Scantling. Like, they've got a lot of veteran wide receivers that can all put up numbers and don't really care if they get passed on. So, I mean, it's a week-to-week basis. Hopefully they can continue against Jacksonville this week, but I'm excited for the season. I think more excited than I was 2 weeks ago. I thought this was going to kind of be a wash. I didn't think they were really going to make the playoffs, but
they've
proved me wrong early. So I guess I'm not always right.
No, well, as we know from last year, I was pretty wrong with Edmonton. And that, you know, that really came to bite me back in the butt. But on the topic of the NFL, just one thing, because I've always heard this. Apparently everyone's favorite team is Dallas.
That's America's team.
Why is that America's team? Just because they're called the Cowboys and they got a star?
Oh, they were just around a long... They've been around a long time, and they were really good back in the day, but
no longer.
I would say they're like, the fans still think they are good, but no, they're not. Yeah. I thought they're
kind of the equivalent of the Toronto Maple Leafs.
They are the equivalent of the Toronto Maple Leafs. That's the best way to put it. Like, they do really well in the regular season, or even sometimes just well, but then they fall apart in the playoffs. I've never seen them in they haven't made a Super Bowl in my time.
Oh yeah, for a long time. Yeah.
But does the NFL have an equivalent to the Montreal Canadiens?
Trying to think.
Probably, I mean, no. I think Montreal is indisputably the greatest franchise in NHL history.
Buffalo Sabres, or not Buffalo Sabres, sorry, Buffalo Bills.
No.
I would say the Green Bay Packers, just because the Packers are the oldest NFL team, and I would say Montreal's the oldest NHL team.
I mean, they did have the most interesting player, I think, in history, Aaron Rodgers.
Oh yeah, they went from Brett Favre to Aaron Rodgers, so two Hall of Fame quarterbacks back to back. That's very rare.
Oh, I just meant more so personality-wise. I mean, Aaron Rodgers, Aaron Rodgers may as well be an influencer at this point. He's so funny.
Yeah, he's actually balling with the Jets this year. He's having a good season.
Big time.
Yeah, yeah. They're calling him Perk Rodgers.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome. And then just one last question, because I was arguing about someone this yesterday, and I didn't know what I was talking about, so I just kind of made up some facts.
Oh, very good.
But the guy came up to me and he said, Peyton Manning is the greatest and most talented quarterback in NFL history. And I said, well, greatest? No, that's probably Tom Brady. And I don't think anyone's going to disclaim that, but most talented.
Mm.
You think that's true? Like, apparently Peyton Manning just wouldn't move and he could hit any target.
Peyton Manning was talented. I would say he's one of the most talented quarterbacks ever.
More talented than the GOAT.
I had this conversation with my friend a couple weeks ago, actually. I think Tom Brady is built on hard work and discipline. Like, if you look at his college stats, he came out of Michigan and he was a sixth round pick. He wasn't highly scouted. He wasn't highly rated. He came in under relief. He played his role as a backup until Belichick called his number. He got in there and never looked back, you know? And I think that maybe he wasn't the most talented quarterback ever, but one of the most disciplined and honestly, one of the better role models you can have. Minus the Deflategate issue. Obviously, the cheating does not look good on him. But other than
I thought that was never proven to be cheating.
Oh, no, it was proven.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, he got suspended a couple games for it at the beginning of one of the seasons. So, yeah, forget what it
oh,
was.
Oh, I didn't think that was proven.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think they ever admitted it, but the NFL found reason that it
to
was
believe,
cheating.
Yeah.
But beyond reasonable doubt. I think Peyton Manning, going back to your point, I think Peyton Manning is probably one of the most talented quarterbacks, if not the most talented. But I still think Tom Brady's the GOAT. Tom Brady's got to be the GOAT. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and then one last thing just before we end this off, we don't usually talk about WNBA, but WNBA is actually become super popular as of late, and most of that has to do with college basketball, right? So college basketball made the rise of WNBA come on. I've been seeing, I don't know if you guys have noticed, but when I've been walking into pubs and other places like restaurants, I've just actually been noticing that I see the WNBA on TV quite a bit more. I don't know if that's just me, but I've just been seeing it on specifically Indiana Fever, but
it's on all the time now. Yeah. I think with Caitlin Clark, carrying the WNBA's viewership. I mean, her and Angel Reese as well have definitely brought a lot of new fans to the WNBA. And I think it's really cool to see because, I mean, I sat down and watched a couple of their games and they're exciting games. In the stands look way more back than they used to. So.
Oh yeah. 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 So anyways, there's lots to kind of build off from this season they have been having, I guess, and it's in the playoffs now for WNBA. I think Indiana Fever with Clayton Clark just had a disappointing game tonight, actually, so they lost. But, definitely lots of potential for that league, and we'll kind of see where it goes from there.
Yeah. No, I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, the playoffs coming up, or they started already, you said?
Yeah, just started.
Nice. Very cool. Very cool. I mean, since we're talking about the WNBA, we might as well talk about the MLB, too, kind of on the same level of excitingness. But the Chicago White Sox lost their 120th game of the season to tie one of the worst records in Major League Baseball. So, thank you, Sam. Oh, Sam, where's Sam going? Sam doesn't want to talk about the Chicago White Sox?
No, Sam does. Sam was just trying to see how much time was left on the clock.
Oh, I see. Well, the Chicago White Sox are tied for the worst MLB season in the history. And you know the MLB. They play like 160 games.
So what does that entail?
They've already got 120 losses. Ooh. So they're not doing too swiftly over there in Chicago.
No.
So what does that mean for them? Just low attendance now? No one really...
No. I think they still manage a somewhat decent attendance, but... I mean, they're better than the Athletics, that's for sure. So Oakland, yeah. Oakland doesn't get too many people out to their games anymore, but the White Sox are definitely treating this as a rebuild year.
But are most MLB stadiums rather vacant in general?
I think not the popular team.
I mean, they're
big
huge.
Market.
Though,
like,
they're
the MLB
huge.
Is still huge. Yeah,
oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
The stadiums are big, too. Like,
yeah. No, definitely the White Sox, I would say. Like, I've never seen a team this bad, so I don't actually, like, they haven't gotten too much news coverage other than for being the worst team. So, I mean, I don't really know.
Any news is good news.
Yeah, I guess so. Good publicity,
exactly.
Right?
Well, on that note, it might be time for us to wrap it up. But thank you so much for joining us on another episode of Plugged in My Ears. We really hope you enjoyed the experience. And as always, we'll be back every week at the same time.
On October 1st and 2nd, you can meet over 115 employers in the main gym of the Athletics and Recreation Center. If you are considering a career in engineering, computing, or technology fields, then join us on October 1st for the Engineering and Technology Fair. On October 2nd,
join CFRC at Kingston Writers Fest 4 at a loss for words with Carol Off on September 29th at 10:45 at the Screening Room. In a world where wokeness and fake news are thrown around as